The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's Ask the Lawyer with Mike Connors. Got questions concerning elder or estate law? Attorney Mike Connors has the answer. He's been recognized as one of New York's top lawyers by New York Magazine and brings nearly 40 years of experience to the table. His office number is 718-238-6500. That's 718-238-6500. Here's Mike Connors.
We are gathered here on hallowed ground. Horses raised, heads bowed down. We'll gather here on hallowed ground to sing this old way.
Welcome to Ask the Lawyer with me, Mike Connors. If this is the first time you heard the show, hey, welcome aboard. If it's not the first time, you know the routine. The first part of the show, we talk about estate planning and elder law. The idea behind estate planning is to pass assets from one generation to the next, paying the least amount in taxes we need to pay legally, avoiding going through court, that's avoiding probate, and as far as elder law is concerned, trying to save assets from nursing home bills. The second part of the show, we talk about politics, history, religion. Today, we're going to be talking about an interesting facet, Africa, East Africa, which I don't know that much about East Africa, and I don't think most of you know there. So we have two people that were in East Africa. Colonel Steve Ryan has been on the show before, and he was stationed there, the American consulate embassy in Nairobi, and Father Patrick Devine, who spent his life in Africa and in the last few years has been in Kenya. He's a very interesting individual, and we're going to be hearing more from Father Devine over the next few weeks. But in the meanwhile, let's start one of our questions about estate planning. And Beth, you've got one floating around?
I've got one that I do, and it's come. This hits us at the office more times than you would think. It's about unclaimed funds. Fairly recently, we had someone come in, and they received a notice saying that a relative had $200,000 worth of unclaimed funds in a bank account. The estate had been closed out. The executor was dead. And this person did not know what to do.
Okay. Well, a lot depends. Of course, this is one of the reasons, hopefully, we have a will. And if we have a will with an alternate executor, the alternate executor can file, in effect, to reopen the estate. If we don't have a will, then somebody else has to file to open up the estate as administrator of the estate. Hopefully, there is somebody who's a relative, at the very least a relative of the administrator of the estate or executor of the estate. And we can get somebody, in all cases, we probably can get somebody to apply to open up the estate. And then we have to send those letters after the surrogate opens up the estate, which is going to take a while. This is probably a process, probably going to take a year or so. But after we get the estate opened up and we get letters of administration to the successor fiduciary who's ever appointed to handle the estate, we send those papers then to Albany, assuming the abandoned property is in New York State. And here's one thing. Let's say you do have a relative that passed away, and this happens a lot. People in their 90s sometimes lose track of their accounts. And they don't know they have accounts, or they forget about their accounts. It could be an old insurance policy that they have a cash value in, and they didn't do anything with it because there were no premiums coming due. Or it could be a bank account. One bank closed out another, and somehow some money was left in the old account. Sometimes, too, you know, like you have stock certificates. You have whatever company, we're going to say AT&T stock certificates, and you had some stock certificates and you switched it over to a broker, but somehow there were maybe some dividends reinvested into stock and whatever, and that didn't get switched over and somebody forgot about it. It might be with abandoned property, unclaimed funds in New York. And you don't lose those assets. You can always put a claim in it. Now, let's say your grandmother died and she owned some assets. Well, you may have to prove who you are, that you're entitled to those assets, which is, again, we may have to open up the estate account for that person. But, you know, and there are also sometimes people have bank accounts. They die, they have a bank account, and they have it in trust for somebody. And the person doesn't know that they had a bank account that was in trust for them, that they were beneficiary. So the account just lingered at the bank. If nobody does anything with the bank after 3 years, the bank can turn the asset over to abandoned property. And then the person who was in trust for his beneficiary can make a claim. And Beth, I know you got the website where you can make a claim in New York.
In New York State, you just type, you do a search, NYS Unclaimed Funds. New York State, NYS Unclaimed Funds, and you'll get their website.
Now, one of the problems with that is they don't tell you what the amount is. So sometimes you don't know whether it's worth pursuing it or not, but that's just part of the game. But check on it if you think there's a relative out there that may have left some assets for any circumstance. You can put anybody's name in and find out what pops open. You know, I mean, it doesn't take you that much time. And put your, you know, your uncle, your aunt's, your grandfather's name, you know, into the computer, see what pops up, and there might be something there. Now, one thing sometimes, which is a problem, the website we just gave you is only for New York State. And occasionally what might happen, if the transfer agent, let's say you own some stocks, and the transfer agent for that company was, let's say, stationed in Michigan or Illinois or someplace like that, it's possible they could have transferred the shares of stock, if nobody claimed them, into unclaimed funds, let's say in Illinois. So to some extent, to be careful, you may have to write every single state in the union. But at the same time, if there's states like New Mexico, Colorado, that are not financial hubs, you wouldn't really name them. But the states like Chicago, I shouldn't say state, but Illinois, which Chicago has listened to, or a state that has a lot of corporations headquartered in it, maybe Delaware, you may want to write them and take it off. But you don't lose assets. Let's say you have a safe deposit box. Your uncle, aunt had a safe deposit box, and nobody did anything on it, and the bank tells you the state took it over. That doesn't mean it's lost. You can put a claim in it. And as far as I know, there's no statute of limitations. We've done claims going back 40-some-odd years. So, you know, if there are any assets out there, if you think there are assets out there, if you know there are assets out there because you either got a letter from somebody, because there are people that try to trace relatives, and a lot of times they're what we call, what you might call headhunters, that if they know there's a substantial amount of assets tied up in abandoned property, they may write you a letter and ask you for a finder's fee. There's nothing wrong with that. The question is, you might want to just check yourself and check with abandoned property, and that way you don't have to pay a finding fee. But at the same time, if the assets are in Michigan, Illinois, Delaware, maybe it's worth your while to pay, you know, the headhunter a filing fee to try to get those assets. It is found money to you. But if you have any questions about that, you can always give us a call at Connors and Sullivan.
What if the person has assets overseas and you don't know anything about it?
I have
it?
No
Are you
idea.
Just stuck? You could
I have no
be.
Idea.
Okay.
I guess it would depend what country. I would assume some countries you really could abandon, could be lost.
Right.
But our overseas countries, I have no idea.
Okay.
Now, real estate, a lot of times, every once in a while, that's why sometimes if you do a will, you don't throw the will away, because every once in a while we find out somebody did a will and then find out that they think nothing, you know, has to be done with the will. But then you find out let's say your father had a piece of property in Ireland that he owned with his brothers or sisters, and maybe we need that will to take care of it. So that's why I never throw out a will. And, you know, it could be any European country. Of course, most European countries, you know, have treaties with the United States where they recognize a will. Of course, real estate goes according to the laws in which the country in which the real estate is located. And the same principle applies in the states. If you have property and there's no will, that will gets passed according to the heirs, according to that state's rules, whatever they are. I mean, most of the United States are going to be pretty much the same. Most of the English Commonwealth nations are going to be pretty much the same. And even in Europe, you have the Napoleonic Code, but in some extent, you have more freedom in the common law nations, English common law nations, to do what you want with your real estate. But the Napoleonic Code is still probably going to go to relatives. But ordinarily, a relative is a person who's descended from a grandparent. If you're not descended from a grandparent, you're not a relative in most of the English-speaking world. Which means, for the sake of argument, if you're a second cousin is not your relative. And I know a lot of people get confused about what is a second cousin and a first cousin once removed. And people get confused about that. A first cousin once removed is somebody who's descended from your grandparents. So if your cousin dies and your cousin has a child, that cousin obviously is descended from your grandparents. Otherwise, they wouldn't be a cousin. We're talking about first cousins. And that child of a first cousin is a first cousin once removed. They are still a relative of yours by law. At the same time, if you have a second cousin, you have somebody who's not descended from your grandparents, in other words, a descendant from your great-grandparents, that is a second cousin, and they are not a relative by law to you. And that comes into play sometimes because to be able to contest a will, at the very least, by relationship, you have to be descended from a grandparent. If you're not descended from a grandparent, you're not a relative, which, of course, and your spouse's relatives, under normal circumstances, your spouse's relatives are not going to be descended from your grandparents. You're going to say, wait a minute, what's going on? Well, you could have cousin marrying cousin or brother and sister marrying brother and sister, and somebody could be, a cousin somewhere else and somehow be related. But under ordinary circumstances, you're not related if you're not a descendant of a grandparent. And that's good or bad, which means your spouse's relatives are not your relatives. Your relatives are not your spouse's relatives, which can be good or bad. They can't contest your will, maybe. But at the same time, if you don't have a will, your assets may go to the state if you do not have descendants of your grandparents. And if there's anybody out there and say, I don't have any relatives, you better start by doing a will, because if something happens, you may have assets that flow through the cracks. You may have bank accounts in trust for everybody's name. You have assets that flow through the cracks. Those assets may pass to New York State if you don't have a will. And I'll tell you what also happens occasionally, and we've seen it recently. If one bank takes over another bank and they lose the designation on the bank accounts, like in other words, one bank takes over, a big bank takes over a smaller bank, the smaller bank's designation on in trust for accounts, beneficiary accounts, IRAs, they lose the beneficiary designation. Sometimes you're going to need that will to collect those assets. Again, everybody needs a will. Now we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be talking to Steve Ryan and Father Divine about Africa, just as an educational point of view. Thank you for listening. Ask the Lawyer.
How can I protect my family if something happens to me?
What if I need to go to a nursing home? What will happen to our savings, our home?
What's the best way to give my home to my kids?
Who will help us take care of Grandpa?
These and many other questions can be answered with a phone call to Connors & Sullivan Attorneys at Law, PLLC, 718-238-6500. Mike Connors, one of New York Magazine's top lawyers, has over 30 years of estate planning and elder law experience. Mike and his team of professionals will help you protect your assets from probate, taxes, and nursing home costs so you can have peace of mind knowing you and your family will be taken care of and protected.
I'm Mike Connors, founder of Connors & Sullivan. People don't plan to fail, they fail to plan. The time to plan is now.
I'm Beth Connors. Call today for a free initial consultation with one of our experienced lawyers.
Connors and Sullivan in Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and Staten Island. Call 718-238-6500. 718-238-6500 or connorsandsullivan.com.
If you're a homeowner age 62 or older and are finding it harder to pay off debt, or how about enjoying your retirement years with less stress? A home equity conversion mortgage may be the answer for you and your family. Hi, this is Frank Melia, a certified mortgage planner, and I've helped countless homeowners all over the tri-state area tap into a little or a lot of their home equity so they can use it right now. Give me a call so our team here at Contour Mortgage can show you how the loan program works and how much you and your family may qualify for. My job is to help you find the best solution for your retirement goals. I do this by educating homeowners with straightforward information and answers. It's free to call and speak with me, Frank Melia, to determine if this mortgage program might be able to help you and your loved ones now. Call and speak with me. I'll answer your questions and help you decide if a reverse mortgage is right for you and your family. Make the call now, 888-954-7463. Once again, that's 888-954-7463, and you could be on your way to a better retirement. Frank Melia, NMLS number 62591, Contour Mortgage Corporation, NMLS number 34384, 990 Stewart Avenue, Suite 660, Garden City, New York, 11530, licensed mortgage banker, New York State Department of Financial Services.
I'm in a good place in my life.
And I'm energized by new adventures.
I've got friends to laugh with.
And a good relationship.
But even though I'm kind of comfortable,
I sometimes wonder, is there something more?
Could God and church be what you're looking for? Come and see at CatholicsComeHome.com.
Time now for Connor's Corner, where Mike takes a closer look at topics like history, politics, religion, and more. Here's Mike.
Welcome to the Connor's Corner segment of Ask the Lawyer. Right now we have two gentlemen who've been on the show before. One, Colonel Steve Ryan, who's been on I don't know how many times, and Father Patrick Devine, who's been on a couple of times. And, you know, we're just talking. They happen to be both around today. And they have one thing in common. They both lived in Kenya for part of their lives. So let's start with you, Steve. When were you in Kenya and what were you doing there?
Yes, so I was assigned to Kenya in 2014 to 2015. And I was assigned there as an Army Reserve officer on a deployment. So it was courtesy of Uncle Sam that I got to go to Kenya and had a great time there.
Father, how did you get to Kenya?
Well, I joined the Society of African Missions. And you made a life commitment to Africa. So first of all, I was assigned to Tanzania. And during my time in Tanzania, I was elected what they call the regional superior for our missionary work in Tanzania and Kenya. So my real involvement in Kenya began in 1995. And I've been very involved ever since.
Let me ask you something. You've been on the show before, but what is the Society of African Missions? What is that?
So the Society of African Missions was founded in 1950, excuse me, the Society of African Missions was founded in 1856 by Monsignor de Bresiac, and everyone that joins the Society of African Missions makes a life commitment to Africa, to mission work in Africa, and the original purpose was to go out and to go to the most abandoned areas and help set up the local church, which is still relevant in many areas, and of course to help with developing medical and educational institutes to help the people, especially those living in poverty, to meet their basic human needs and actualize their potential.
Now, what? I'll start with Colonel Ryan. What's life like for you in Kenya?
Well, I got there by accident, really. I was originally assigned to Djibouti at Camp Lemigne, and I was sent there, which was supposed to be only for about maybe a month or two, because the lieutenant colonel I was replacing was frankly pushed out. So they weren't happy with him. So I went in as a temporary replacement, but the Kenyans fell in love with me and they wouldn't let me go. So I was actually stationed there for a year. But I had a great time. I was principally assigned to the International Peace Training Center in Karen. Now, some people might have seen the movie with Out of Africa with Robert Redford and... I'm forgetting her name. Meryl Streep. And it takes place in Karen. And the house that they filmed the movie in, it was the actual house she lived in, was literally almost down the block from where I was. So that was another thing I got to do. But I had a really good time. I worked hard, but also played hard.
Now, before we came in, before we went on the air, you guys were talking about what it was like to drive in Nairobi. Father, do you want to go with your comments on that?
Well, I mean, the morning hours and the evening hours from 5 o'clock onwards up until 7 or 8, traffic is very heavy, a lot of congestion, and you know, you can be moving very slowly. And I just made the joke that one of the golden attitudes to have is that he who hesitates or she who hesitates never moves.
And yeah. I understand it's pretty dangerous to drive at night there.
Well, you know, I didn't do a lot of night driving, actually, come to think of it. Well, like maybe up until maybe 9 p.m., but I had a good driver. We had drivers assigned to us from the embassy. They wanted Kenyan nationals to drive because they didn't want Americans to get into a fender bender, because then they'll be suing the U.S. government and, you know, taking us for everything we're worth. So that was the way of kind of working around that. So, but I had a fantastic driver. His name is David, that I still keep in contact with, and his family. And so I was living in sort of the outskirts of Nairobi, not far from the U.S. Embassy, the new U.S. Embassy. The other one that got hit in 1998, of course, was more in the downtown Nairobi, you know, right in the city. This, where we were, would be more or less kind of like the outer suburb. And there were other embassies right near us. We had Canada. The UN was literally across the street from us. But my house that I was in, which is like an embassy house, was just a few blocks away.
And I would say then that in the last 15 years, the road infrastructure, particularly around Nairobi and other parts of Kenya, has improved. And even there's an overhead highway at the moment dissecting the city.
Now, how many ethnic groups or tribes are there in Kenya?
Oh, boy. At least 40.
Yes. I can say 46.
Oh,
yes. But, you know, there's always another couple that you could say are or are not, and they're mixed with some other ethnic community.
So what's the difference between the different ethnic communities?
Well, there is language. When you're talking to someone from Kenya, let's say, particularly, and a lot of them do speak English because it was at one time, you know, a British colony, it's amazing because they're actually translating at least three languages. They're a tribal language. There's also Swahili, which is really a language that was invented for trade, particularly when the Arabs would trade with them in, like, Mombasa and then the east coast of Africa. So they're actually growing up learning at least three languages, right? Their tribal language, Swahili, and in English.
Yes, the national language of in not just for Kenya but Tanzania and other is Kiswahili.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
Now, a lot of us, you know, here in the United States, when you mention different countries, whether it's Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, they're all the same to us. It's a little bit like some Americans feel like South America, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. And as Ronald Reagan said, they're different countries.
And they certainly are. And some of them get along and some of them don't. For a large part, the East African countries get along very well trade-wise. They cooperate with one another. For an example, they were putting together the East African Standby Force when I was there, which was going to be sort of a miniaturized NATO in that region of Africa to respond to emergencies. If there was an election, they were worried about instability, that this could be an international force that could go in to assist a struggling country like Burundi. It consisted of Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania. You also had Djibouti. Eritrea didn't want anything to do with us. Sudan kind of had their own problems with the ongoing civil difficulties they're having there, where it's when the country eventually split in half. People think Africa is like one country. It is not. You got to look at it kind of like Europe, right? You got Austria, Germany, you got Italy and Greece and, you know, Turkey. So, no, you can't just say, yeah, it's Africa. You know, when we go to the Museum of Natural History and go into the Africa section, I get it. But if you go into at least where they go into the culture in the rear part, past where the animal dioramas are, you know, they do a very good job of breaking it down. Also, if you really want to know more about it, the Brooklyn Museum, which we used to call the Brooklyn Museum of Art when we were kids down on Eastern Parkway, excellent African display and history and collection of art and culture, and it really does a very good job of breaking it down for a layman. someone who doesn't know about it. You know.
Now, Steve, we know you lived in an embassy house. Father, where do you live?
Well, I live at a mission house, you know, like, and usually we live in community, and we have missions as far north as Turkana, up in the northwest of Kenya. It's a very poor, it's barren, semi-arid environment, and then we also have mission stations around Nairobi, especially in new satellite areas building up around the city, and as I mentioned earlier, in the Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation, we work a lot of the time in the slums as well around Nairobi, as well as up in the areas of interethnic conflict up along the border with Somalia, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Uganda.
And what kind of, what, you mentioned something about elections and how 60,000 people were maimed in one election.
Yes, in the election of 2007. And then it was at the end of 2007 into 2008, there was a lot of violence. I think it's fair to say that in 2002, that was the end of the era of Daniel Arap Moi in governance, and you had multi-party elections coming in, and it's difficult. Let me put it in another way. Elections, I would say, in Kenya aren't so much about ideology, policy ideology of left-wing, right-wing, labour, conservatism. A lot of the time still, it's around ethnic mathematics.
Yeah.
And but it's changing slowly and for the better. So in the 2008 violence, it was very severe. And America played a huge role in bringing about peace. The interventions of the United States of America. That's a fact, and I think they had a huge role in bringing about peace and settling that conflict.
How did they do that? Just because I don't think a lot of people know that.
Well, especially it was through diplomacy, but also the violence, I think, was getting so bad and severe that there was even threats, we say, from the international community of bringing a UN force on the ground for peacekeeping. And I think my understanding is all parties did not wish to see that happening, and they came to their senses and negotiations happened and peace emerged. There was also some violence in 2013, a little in 2017, but thank God in the last election it was peaceful throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
What about terrorism in East Africa?
So you have, you have ISIS in Africa, and you also have Al-Shabaab, which has been causing instability, obviously, in Somalia, which is just north of Kenya. Kenya borders the southern part of Somalia. When I was there, the Kenyans were trying to ask the countries of the West to help secure their border physically in several ways. One, actually, like building a wall, literally, and the other one was providing some training for their troops. Particularly sniper training, because the terrorists were sneaking across the border. A lot of this, what brought it to light, was the attack in 2013 in the shopping mall in Nairobi, where it hit all the headline news. People saw it on
the
CNN.
The Westgate Mall,
right? And which I visited, actually. And it looks like any mall in America. It's a modern-looking mall with modern shops and stuff that you would see in any mall here in the United States. And I think a lot of Americans would be very comfortable there, frankly. But that was a major concern, that there was a shortfall somewhere that they needed to do. So they started putting their armed security police, which is like kind of like our state police, although they look like they're in the Army because they're wearing like the camouflage, but and a beret, and that's the way you can kind of distinguish them. So they wanted to make it, you know, people feel safe, and the Kenyans did. What the Kenyans were not happy about when I was there was that they were on this, not a terrorist watch list, but like the travel advisory, that Kenya was dangerous, and that had a very bad impact on the tourism in Kenya, which is heavily dependent on people coming from the West, Europe, and the United States to go on safari. If anyone wanted to go on safari, I know people also mentioned South Africa, I tell them to go to Kenya. The food's great. You're not going to get sick. The water you can drink out of the faucet. Kenyans are like the Irish of Africa. I call them the most friendliest people in the world, and they're also the most hardworking. And they can build anything from nothing, furniture-wise, anything. I'm just I was really blown away, and, you know, in every regard. And I love Kenya, and I'll go back tomorrow.
And I would add, you know, if you think of the Maasai Mara, and you have other...
Oh, yeah, Maasai Mara, you want to see elephants.
And down in Tanzania, the Serengeti.
Right.
Just incredible, the naturalness of these wildlife.
And I always tell people, like they'll say to me, when should I go? Yes. I always say late August into early September, roughly around our Labor Day, because that's when the wildebeest are making the migration, Tanzania and Kenya. Mm. And that's when you're going to catch all the life. You're going to see all the lions waiting for them. So that's really like a convention of all the animals in Africa. But that's the time to go.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you can't go any other time of the year, but that's definitely one of them.
And then just to come back as well to the issue of terrorism. I mean, radicalization and extremism in Africa, the dynamics and drivers. There's a whole variety of underpinning the causes of radicalization and extremism in Africa. But just on the issue of religion, I think it's important to point out, because this question often is posed, like, is religion the cause of a lot of conflict? So my view has always been, and from my studies as well, is that religion is not the underlying cause of conflict, but it certainly can become a major factor when it's energized or preoccupied with quantitative institutional membership rather than qualitative spiritual transformation. In simple terms, when the institutions of religion become more important than the message. And if you look across, most religions have messages of peace and justice and truth and mercy, but they're often forfeited for the sake of other aims. And that is the pity with terrorism. It does that, and it takes away this where we should be able to live together in harmony.
Have you ever come across terrorists in your mission?
Well, I've been in conflict zones, so I've been in...
Now, what's a conflict zone, just for our audience?
A conflict zone, well, you can be in an intertribal conflict zone where people are killed and maimed and displaced, and I've witnessed that and been in the scenes of the aftermath of battles and so on. Down at the coast, of course, as mentioned, you're dealing with the more clandestine forces of terrorism, much more dangerous, so you have to be very careful for your life down there in your attempt to transform. But I really believe to transform and prevent, you must do it from the bottom up. You need from the top down as well, but you need from the bottom up to make sure that the people living in society are trained to be able to perceive the dangers and also to prevent.
How roughly do you do that? I mean, that sounds like... How do you do that?
Well, it's like the distinction between peacekeeping and peace building. You can peacekeep and it'll be forever there. But unless you bring about conflict transformation, and you really need to have skills and techniques on this. And you have to empower the people to be the architects of their own future.
How is your message being received, Father? I mean...
Well, for us anyhow, for our team, and as I may have mentioned in an earlier interview, you know, everybody, we have them qualified with a minimum of a master's in their area, because we really want people who know what they're talking about in terms of analytical skills and peace-building techniques, because it's not an environment where you want wishy-washy, holy Joe intentions alone, right? You really need to have quality people at it, and you need people committed that are willing to go behind the lines into the conflict zones. My experience with the people, they have been very receptive. Because in general, most people, they want to live in peace and live normal lives and get married and have children and see their children develop and so on. I don't know, Colonel, like, I mean, you're coming in from a different angle, but it's the same purpose at the end of the day.
Right, and that's why the emphasis where I was assigned, even though I worked out of the embassy, I was assigned the International Peace Training Center in Karen, and that's precisely ties into what you were speaking about, was bringing in militaries from Africa to train them to do peacekeeping operations, because it wasn't like regular kinetic combat fighting.
That's right.
It was trying to be everything, social worker.
Sure.
You know,
yes.
A shoulder to cry on, whatever it need, introducing civil military operations, civil affairs, working heavily with the United Nations. So learning how the UN operates as a bureaucracy, because it is, and how to work the logistics end of it to bring much needed aid to the people that need it the most, and how to do it in the most efficient manner.
Right.
A lot of times when our U.S. troops would go down to help them, they were like, they knew our way and NATO's way, but it's not, because the UN does it a little differently, so they had to do an adjustment. The Canadians, I found, were usually the best at that, because they do a lot of that.
Mm.
And Ireland, to also Republic of Ireland. So the U.S., we really, you know, if we were in Africa, you know, we had the incident in Somalia and we did that and we kind of tried to stay away from them. But we're there. We're still in Djibouti. We still have a presence in Somalia. Everybody thinks we left. We never really left. We, you know, we're occupying the area of the airport. We don't have an ambassador there right now. But a lot of what we were doing in Kenya was in support of trying to get Somalia back on its feet.
Sure.
And the problem is a lot of Western nations, frankly, just don't want to. Just don't want to touch it, you know, because it's just this is really difficult.
It's a very difficult.
They feel it's almost unsolvable, but I don't think that's the case. In speaking about the religions, the three major religions I know is like Roman Catholic, obviously Anglican, and Muslim. When I was there, they got along. At least they did in front of me. I remember particularly we were at the Kenyan Military National Cemetery in Kenya, and we were commemorating World War One because yes. People forget this: Kenyan soldiers died in Europe.
Yes.
In the trenches, along with French and British and Australian and everyone else in the British Empire. And they were commemorating them, and a lot of them were actually buried in Kenya, managed to come back, and to be buried at least. And we had all three faiths at this commemoration, sure. And this was in 2014 because it marked 1914, the centennial, the beginning of the First World War.
Sure. And I want to just add that I have really enjoyed coming over here, giving lectures at various universities in the USA, most recently up at the Kennedy School of Governance, Public Policy, as well in University of San Diego, University of Texas, DePaul University in Chicago, and a great openness to try and understand the dynamics of what's needed for conflict transformation as distinct from just peacekeeping. But the peacekeeping is so important, so it's never to be diminished. And the role of America in Africa has been very, very important. And it should never take its eye off Africa because it's needed. And I don't think any other nation on this planet provides more aid, and particularly in times of humanitarian disasters, and that needs to be stated as well, regardless of which government or which party is in power. I think that's a fair statement, Carl.
Right, I think that there's no argument there, because what they see is that we really started to pay attention to Africa more after 9/11, because we realized that terrorist networks were looking for a place of instability,
yes,
where they can thrive. So we have to be there. I mean, we've got France and we have other nations there. The British are still there helping us in Canada. So, yes, absolutely. And also that's got our attention is China is, you know, playing around there. Like, they'll go to a country like Kenya, promise to build them a highway, and they do, but there's a price to be paid because they want to rip all their minerals out of the ground to build stuff, components for cell phones and electric cars and whatnot. And, of course, the Russians can't help themselves. They're trying to stir up problems in Sudan with, you know, the Wagner Group. So we're not leaving anytime soon. I can tell you that.
Steve, do you have any? Why do the Russians want to stir up problems? What's the point behind it?
I never quite fully
understood it.
Yeah. Well, they're saying even Wagner Group guys that fought in Ukraine just recently are now down in Sudan starting up stuff. I think it's basically to stick it to us and make it more difficult for the Western nations to try to do business down there, just to be a disruptor. Plus, Russia's not fooled. There are great natural resources in Africa they're looking to exploit, particularly they were trying to get in. I think Uganda finally, yes, told them to get the hell out.
Yeah, you know? But I think it's an important point to bring up that a lot of conflict in Africa, there are internal causes for the conflict, but there are external factors as well. And if you think about it now, in the geopolitics of the world we live in, it's more and more difficult for the West to exploit the East or the East the West. And then you have this massive continent in the middle, Africa, where institutions are still very weak and has huge resources of minerals underground. And I mean, a lot of the powers are vying for that. And,
right,
you know, what we need to be, which Colonel has pointed out, you never want Africa to sell its soul, just to sell its resources and to be manipulated so that at the end of the day they get the weaker end of the stick or the poorer end of the bargain.
And I'll tell you another thing, Father, you know this, the terrible things going on, particularly with elephants. Right now in the American Museum of Natural History, for people living in New York City, there's a special exposition on elephants. Mm. The ivory trade. the Kenyans started to burn the ivory. They banned hunting back in the 1960s, actually. And now it's more conservation. You know, you want to shoot animals, do it with your camera. Don't do it with a rifle. In the sense of Africa, these endangered species, rhinos, there's a heavy demand from Asia. Japan and China are the biggest culprits, I'm sorry to say, in this, particularly Red China, where they'll go in as tourists into a national park in Kenya and then come back that night and they set up traps for these elephants and they die and then they try to take and they cut off their ivory. And of course they're going to have culprits in Kenya who go along with it. Some of them are paying off their border security, you know, in there. So unfortunately, there's been talks about Western militaries maybe even coming in to try to save the elephants, because the elephants are particularly important to the environment with climate change. Elephants, honestly, by dropping their dung everywhere, actually spread seed around Africa and help keep it irrigated. When elephants dig
on the ground, they don't contribute to global warming by
that? Sure they do at some point, but they dig a lot of holes, which create the water holes that actually keep the water even in the dry season, which enable other animals to sustain themselves. You lose the elephants, you're going to lose all the other animals. It's going to be a chain reaction. So I think it that's going to affect the weather on the planet, obviously.
Father, do you have hope for Africa in the long run?
I really am, and I'm very positive about the future of Africa, and with the growth of education throughout the continent, and it's developing universities, and they have a very educated classes coming up, and people in really poor areas now where we are setting up schools and all that, some of those students have gone on to university, and they're big into the tech as well. And a lot of companies now in the West are beginning to use Africa, this outreach programs they have, and a lot of people very well qualified. So I am very positive about it, but that doesn't mean that we're to leave it on its own. It needs help as well, as does every other country in the world from that point of view.
Now, we talked about this before, but could you bring in your organization, Shalom? Can you tell the audience about it? Because not everybody listens to every show, obviously.
Well, to give it in brief, right, Shalom was set up in 2009 to address the underlying causes of conflict, particularly addressing conflict in the area of inter-ethnic conflict, religious ideological extremism, violence against women and children. So it was decided from the very beginning that everyone would have a minimum of a master's degree and everyone to commit to work within conflict zones. Of addressing these issues. So we are up along the borders with Ethiopia, South Sudan, Uganda. We're down at the coast as well, particularly addressing religious ideological extremism there. Basically, what we're maintaining is that in African conflict environments where people are killed and maimed and displaced persistently, it's very difficult for social and religious values such as peace and truth and justice and mercy to take deep root, for people to live normal lives and experience true peace. And secondly, in those same environments, it's very difficult to have any sustainable development, because periodically schools and hospitals, churches, etc., either become inoperable or destroyed. So do we want to forever keep pouring money through a sieve, addressing the symptoms, or do we tackle the underlying causes? And we have set up Shalom with the full backing of various religions, the church, and they have endorsed it. They find it fantastic, in particular for those who are interested in getting those values to take deep root and to bring about sustainable development.
And again, if you can talk about the Mary and Joseph Life Center.
So the Mary and Joseph Life Center, of course, its origin was through our work addressing violence against women and children, particularly in the slums around Nairobi. But then we came across other issues. The women from our team were on about all the young women who are being forced to give up their the unborn child, or abortions, because they were being forced by various members of their communities and families. So we decided, well, we would give them the option of having their baby born. And secondly, to help them with psychological, spiritual and economic livelihood resilience. And for all women who had abortions and were going through difficulties of one form or another, to offer healing and trauma help and so on.
Is Planned Parenthood active in Africa?
Let's put it this way. There's a lot of forces who are trying to change the African culture And also the laws of African nations to bring in abortion throughout. And it's really an issue that should not go unnoticed.
Can you amplify on that? What's happening? What is Planned Parenthood doing in Africa?
Well, I would say a wide variety of organizations that are promoting what we would consider unethical and immoral practices, and certainly not in line with the dignity of life that the Africans themselves hold for the unborn. Sometimes this can be very clandestine because they have to respect the constitutions. But, I mean, the fact is, I think that there's a statistic there from 2012 or 2013. In the slums around Nairobi, over 360,000 abortions took place.
In 1 year?
In 1 year. Now, I'm not saying that that was all from the forces that are promoting abortion, but from other reasons and difficulties.
All right, we're going to wrap up, but Father, can you give us your website where people can find more about your mission?
Well, we are on www.shalomconflictcenter.org and also the www.maryandjosephlifecenter.org. We have an office here in New York, and we are a registered 501c3.
Which means if somebody sends you a check, they get a tax deduction.
They get a tax deduct, and every contribution is responded to, so to help people in that process. So we really need the help, you know, because it's very difficult in the environments where we are to raise funds. So we come over here, and we believe that we need to look outside, because what happens outside in Africa, if we don't address those problems, eventually they can bite us here. And that goes for terrorism, it can go for a variety of other issues.
Steve, do you have any other comments as we wrap up?
Well, I think there is great hope, because the world is getting smaller with social media and cell phones and whatnot, that people are more aware of what's going on. So I think it's for a struggling democracy, for Kenya, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, because they can't get away with what they can get away with, because so much public opinion, social media is such a contributing factor to be a check on, you know, good governance, particularly like in Kenya. I remember when Barack Obama came to visit in 2015, the people were happy, and the first thing they kept saying, you got to help us something with the corruption. You know, yes. They literally thought, you know, President Obama could basically come in and clean it up in a month, you know. But that being said, you know, he had John Kerry come after that as Secretary of State. Sure. And so it wasn't like we came in, all right, guys, nice to see you, I'm going to go back to Washington. We stayed. We didn't leave. We were putting things in places and working heavily with our other Western allies to help them, you know, even in the judicial side, in the courts, you know, sure, things of that nature. So, and the newspapers particularly hold them very accountable. I mean, every day they're calling people out. Now, sometimes people got off easy because, yes, there is corruption, of course, but it's not so easy anymore because they're being watched and people are complaining.
And I think the more and more institutions develop, the more and more you can control that.
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's great hope.
I'm very big on this, the importance of developing institutions. Right. Because they underpin so much of human behavior.
And I would just tell everybody out there, if you're thinking of going to Africa, I'm telling you, Kenya, because I'm going to go back.
Okay, well, that helps the economy, and
absolutely.
That must help everybody.
Yep. So,
I'm a big fan of Eastern Africa, so welcome everybody out there.
Father Colonel, thank you for being on Connor's Corner.
Do you have somewhere to sleep? Did you eat today? Are you making ends meet? For thousands of New Yorkers, the answer is no. For children and youth, adults, seniors, people struggling with addiction or mental illness, and for the isolated, Catholic Charities of Brooklyn and Queens is there. With 160 programs and more than 4,500 units of affordable housing, Catholic Charities is one of the largest multi-service charitable organizations in the nation. We help change lives and build communities. If you or someone you know needs assistance, call 718-722-6001 or visit ccbq.org.
Welcome back to Ask the Lawyer with me, Mike Connors. Thanks again to Colonel Ryan and to Father Divine. And we're going to be hearing more from Father Divine in a few more weeks, talking specifically about his mission in Africa. And it's really an astounding piece of work. And one of the things he told us after we got off the air is I think there are about 3,000 seminarians in Kenya right now, which I think is a remarkable accomplishment.
And it's because of missionaries like Father Divine who are bringing the church to Africa. In any event, if you want to learn more about estate planning, hey, we do have seminars coming up at the end of April. So, Beth, when are our seminars?
All right. Wednesday, April 24th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. we'll be at Connolly's Corner, Grand Avenue, Queens. Thursday, April 25th, we'll be at Don Roberto's Classic Italian Restaurant, 616 Forest Avenue in Staten Island. It'll be 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock. Friday, April the 26th, we'll be in Bayside, Adria Hotel and Conference Center, 221-17 Northern Boulevard. That one is at 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Now we go to Monday, April the 29th. We'll be at Greenhouse Cafe, Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. And the last one is Tuesday, April 30th, Buckley's Restaurant and Caterers, Avenue S in Brooklyn. Tuesday, April 30th, 11 a.m. and 3 p.m.
All right, so if you'd like to attend one of our seminars, please do so, but please give us a call so we can have proper seating arrangements. Give us a call at 238-6500, 238-6500. And one warning, the seminar at the Greenhouse Cafe, the evening seminar is going to be taped because I have a conflict that came up. So that'll be taped, but there'll be a lawyer and paralegals there from our office who can answer your questions and schedule an appointment if you want with me. Again, if you're at the seminars, you want to schedule there, you can do so. Just, you know, bring in your schedule if you want. I go to each one of the offices, whether it's Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, or Manhattan. If you want to speak to me, you're more than welcome to speak with me. Just give us a call at 718-238-6500, 718-238-6500. And if you have any questions about estate planning, please feel free to ask the questions there. You know, we'll take as many questions from the floor as possible. We always stay as late as we can, and we usually answer, I think, all of the questions. So hope to see you at one of the seminars. Again, please give us a call at 718-238-6500. Thank you for listening to Ask the Lawyer with me, Mike Connors.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Here on hallowed ground, the voices raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this song away.
We are gathered here
on hallowed ground, the voices raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this song away.
Hi, Kevin McCullough. Are you or your parents' assets protected from nursing home bills? Did you know these bills can exceed $15,000 a month? People work their entire lives to live comfortably in retirement, but when people become ill and need to go to a nursing home or receive home care, the bills can drain their assets, leaving many people bankrupt. The good news is that you can prevent that from happening if you plan in advance. Connors and Sullivan's lawyers can customize a plan that specifically protects your interests, including your home. Schedule a free comprehensive telephone consultation with Mike Connors to discuss your issues and concerns from the security of your home. Call today, 718-238-6500, 718-238-6500. Don't let nursing home bills take your life's savings and leave you and your loved ones bankrupt. Don't wait another minute. Mike Connors can take you through the process by telephone and start a plan designed for you today. That's 718-238-6500. 718-238-6500.
The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Connors and Sullivan Attorneys at Law, PLLC.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.